What can I say? What can I say about Good Friday that hasn't been said already? We're in the aftermath of faith, you know. There was a time when I was studying in Maynooth, I used to love Holy Week because we always had a silent retreat, and the only noise or disturbance of the silence was when you went to the Great Gun Chapel for liturgies. And the liturgies of Holy Week are just remarkably intense. The Eucharist, the breaking of bread and the sharing of the cup on Holy Thursday, you know, the moment when you think about what the whole idea of the Christian religion means, the presence of manifestation, incarnation of divinity in this moment. And this moment then ritualized in the Eucharist, which continues and continues and continues all the time, timelessly. You know, every time you go into Mass, you're entering a timeless space. The liturgies are like the architecture of heaven within our world, if you like. The eternal becomes present. And once you're in that space, you know, once you're stepping across a threshold, if you think about the Eucharist like that. I remember one time, this was about 3 or 4 months after I was ordained a priest, and I had gone to Italy with John O'Donoghue. We were two young lads, about 30 years of age. No, about 28, 27. And I came back on my own, and I stopped off in Paris. And so every day I used to find somewhere to say a Mass, break the bread. And I couldn't resist on one occasion going into Notre Dame and asking, was it okay to say Mass there? And I had a credential, you know, I had a kind of an identification thing that validated the fact that I was a priest. And they had no big bother with it, but the way it used to happen was round the back of the main altar in Notre Dame, there were all these small side altars. And each one was in a kind of a cage, you know, those big iron bars like in a jail, and a gate opened into it. And so you got delegated to say your Mass privately in one of these spaces. And I went round, I got the vestments on and got the chalice, and you walk out of the sacristy and there's a fella leading you, a kind of a security guy, and he has the key. And then he opened the gate in this, you know, all these bars in a little side altar. And I went in, and then he closed it again, and I could hear him locking it. Because obviously he was going back to the sacristy. And I'm sure he had loads of other things to do. So the system was, when there was a priest wanted to say Mass, you escorted him to one of the, like, cubicles, if you like, little side altars, which were all enclosed. You let him in, and then you closed the door behind him. So he was locked in, and presumably he'd have remembered to go back and check when he'd be finished. Otherwise, obviously, I'd be stuck inside the bars like in a jail. What surprised me was that when I came to the consecration of in the Eucharist, where you bless the bread and the wine, there was a crowd of people, tourists, had gathered behind me. And I couldn't see them, and you couldn't, if you were saying Mass with your back to the crowd, you couldn't actually like turn around and say, how are you? So I could only imagine what was behind me, but it really sounded like there was quite a crowd. And as I raised the bread and I raised the chalice above my head in the ritual of consecration, you could hear the cameras clicking. You could hear dozens of cameras clicking frantically to grasp the moment, you know. And when I was finished and I turned round to come out, and the fella had come back, the security man had come back with the keys and unlocked the gate, and he was leading me out, I could see there were a huge amount of Japanese. And I imagined them going back to Tokyo or Nagasaki or wherever and getting out the photographs, you know. And they'd be getting them developed, and they'd probably have 10 or 20 photographs of Notre Dame, and they'd be showing them to their friends or their children or their parents. And they'd be saying, oh, look, and look, this is one, he is a priest now, and he is doing something very important. I just can't imagine how they would describe what was happening at that moment, you know. Maybe there'd be Catholics fully understanding it, but there was something voyeuristic that they were taking photographs of the consecration, that it suggested to me that they probably are experiencing it as remote, you know, that we might go to a Shinto temple or a Buddhist temple and feel that what's going on there is remote and exotic, and we might want a picture of it, and that was the way that they were experiencing me behind the bars doing my little prayer, saying my mass. But I thought about that too, and I thought, like, how would you describe what's happening? In the old days, it was spoken of very reverently and very intensely, that moment, the consecration. I used to, when I was an altar boy in the cathedral in Cavan so many decades ago, and if your role was to ring the bell, so you'd be kneeling at the foot of the altar, at the bottom of the steps, and in Cavan there were steps up to the altar, and the priest in those days had his back again to the congregation. And once, you know, when the bread went, the host went above his head, there was a furious ringing of the bell. You had to get that right. And then when the chalice went up above his head, you had to get that and ring the bell. And before that, there was a moment where the priest would put his two hands over the bread and over the chalice, like his hands flat together, and he'd reach them out and put them over the chalice. We didn't know what he was saying when we were children. He was saying something like, we ask you to come upon these gifts and make them holy, and that they may become for us the body and blood of our Lord Jesus. So it's an invocation that the Spirit will come and transform these material things. It's a kind of an invocation of where we're going in the next few seconds. And that got a bell ringing as well. That was the first ringing of the bell to notify everybody it's about to happen. And what happened, what was about to happen, was simply that the priest then spoke the words from the gospel that describe what happened on that first night. When he was at the table, he took bread and gave you thanks and gave it to his disciples and said to them, take it and eat. This is my body. which will be given for you. Do this in memory of me. So the declaration is Jesus saying, as he looks at the bread, and he's saying, this is my body. So he's sharing the bread at the table. He wants people to share the bread. But he says, this is my body. He knows what's coming. He knows he's going to be arrested. He knows he's in trouble. And it's going to end badly. And he says, this is my body. I get that, you know, I get that as an act of love. I get that. I could see that happening informally at any table. If you were on the verge of something as dramatic as a revolution or being arrested or being executed, you know. So it's a communion between people that could happen simply in love. You know, it wasn't invented by religion. It is that an ordinary human thing was absorbed into the liturgy. And that's the moment, a moment of solidarity. And then the last phrase he says, do this in memory of me. So when the priest in the little side altar with the bars, the iron bars like a jail, when the priest is in there with his back to the audience, and the audience are outside the gate with their cameras from Japan, they are seeing somebody who first invokes, you know, come Holy Spirit, let these material things be for us the body and blood of Christ. And then he actually says the words, so he becomes Christ. He's like an actor, really, you know. He is in the place of Christ saying the words. And in that moment, it's like the Eucharistic moment as it began is happening again. It's eternal. This moment is the eternal present, really. Be here now. And in some way, by reenacting, you know, by saying the words, it emphasizes the feeling that you're in a space which is eternal, eternally present, rather than historical. And that's the ritual, that's the liturgy. And I see when I come out, there's so many people and they're looking, and they're obviously from Asia, they're from Japan, and they have cameras. And I think, how will they deal with this moment? And here's the funny thing. My instinct is that they would deal with it very well. That they would understand it completely. Even, I'm not talking about them if they're Catholic or Christian, obviously then they'd be fully on board with it. But I'm saying that in those days where we had much less television and much less, with no internet, we had much less communication between one end of the globe and the other. And so when you came to a different country, even when I came from Ireland to France, it seemed much, much more like a different universe than Ireland. We had less reference points to connect us. And so for me then, you know, breaking the bread and being present in that way was really special, because it was like affirming not just the eternal present, being here now. It wasn't just saying that this can happen in any culture. It's universal. But it's also timeless. So it crosses time and it crosses space. We are all one in this moment. And my feeling is that every culture everywhere, always, has figured out that part of being human is experiencing in yourself a sense of eternity. When you enter into the present moment, when you enter into this moment now, you enter into a kind of a space that it transcends time. And that's something I think I see it when I practice Buddhist practices. I see it when, or I feel it when I read magnificent, beautiful Sufi and Muslim Islamic texts. This sense of the transcendent presence or being in all things is a universal. It's a universal truth. It's like God is not a Catholic, you know. God is not confined to a religion, but. And I have to say, I was walking on the beach this morning, about 2 hours ago, in Carrickfinn, in Donegal, and there's a huge rise in the sense of energy and light and springtime, even though we're just at the end of March. But there's a wonderful sense of growth and life. And it's so resilient. And there are more people, because I've been walking around that beach in the winter when I'd be here and I'm working on maybe a new book. And sometimes it would be deserted. And sometimes you'd go into, you know, Letterkenny or Dunloe, and the streets would be empty, and they would be windswept, and there would be rain and coldness and sleet. And all of a sudden, just around Easter, you realise there's more cars, there's more visitors, there's more people walking the beach. And in a day or two, the clocks will go forward and we'll be able to walk on the beach in daylight until 7 and then 8 in the evening. So there's a powerful sense of life and resurrection in Easter, at the Easter weekend, even without the Christian symbolism. I think that the Christian symbolism brings us deeper. I think it brings us into a deeper, more solid psychic space, which is to do with the intensity of joy there is in the present moment. And you have to unravel the whole Christian idea, the whole Christian, like, tapestry of meaning in the narrative of Jesus on Holy Week to really get to Easter. You know, you can't just take Easter as a sudden idea, but it's the journey that Jesus makes, where he's with his companions and he's saying, this life is given for you, do this in memory of me. And he does it in a ritual, and you can see that in the ritual, the most central thing is the life given for others. And again, you can see that in that simple idea of compassion, sacrifice, life given for others. It doesn't mean that you're looking for an unhappy life, but it means that if you can live your life for somebody else, might be somebody in your family or all your family, but it can be a kind of a global thing as well, you know. In Buddhist tradition, they call it the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva is somebody who takes a vow that dedicates their life to others. It's like that you'll always be a Buddha for other people, and that your intention will be not to just reach enlightenment for yourself, but to reach enlightenment in order that you can draw other people to enlightenment, and that you won't be satisfied until everybody is enlightened. You also get it, like, you know, when when somebody dedicates themselves to an organization in the parish or in the community, in the village or the town, and they work for the betterment of other people or you know, health charities or, you know, organizations that support alleviating the suffering of animals or reaching out to people in other countries and other continents that are poor and suffering injustice. There's so many ways you can live for others. And there's so many little ways you can live for others. Like, you can get up in the morning and you can think of yourself. I do it all the time intensely. I mean, I think that's what makes me sometimes neurotic. You know? I get out of bed, even before I've got out of bed, I'm worrying about myself. I'm checking my body to see, did I sleep well? Am I exhausted? Will I be fit to get through the day? How's my health? What are the aches and pains that are going to afflict me today in my journey towards old age? I go on like that sometimes, there's no doubt. And then I'm obsessed in the kitchen as to whether I should have porridge on its own, or maybe a boiled egg, or maybe a fried egg with it. And then I'm thinking, well, maybe the fried egg would affect the heart, the cholesterol. Maybe I won't, maybe I will, you know. And what should I put on the porridge? And am I taking too much porridge or too little porridge? Because porridge could be good for you, but it might be bad for you. And there you go. You're there opening and closing the fridge, and you're obsessed with yourself. And I go on like that all the time. And sometimes when the lady wife is with me, I don't go on like that because I have somebody that I can pay attention to. And sometimes when I'm working on my own, you can get really locked into self-obsessions, you know. Have I walked enough today? Did I do enough steps today? What did I drink last night? Did I have two drinks or three? Was that too much? You know. And all the time you're worried about the underlying mortality, you know, that life isn't forever. And yet you enter into a moment, you know, a moment of being in the present, where it's like life will be forever. It's not that life will be forever. You can see in some sense that there's a disparity between the life that you're living on the surface and the eternity. The eternity. And that eternity is, I don't mean it as an idea, I mean it as an experience that you, I'd say you do experience it. I'm talking to you now, I don't know who you are, but the fact that you even listen to this sort of podcast is probably because in your own journey in life, you have found the secret of peace, of being in the present moment. And you probably listened to this podcast because in some accidental way it pleases you, or it kind of sustains you in your own experience, in your own faith journey. This is not a podcast where I'm trying to, you know, convince you of an idea or, you know, bring you to Jesus or something. No. Or bring you to Allah or Buddha. I take them all as the languages that you use, that other people use to find peace and wellness. And probably people listening to me have already realized where that truth is. It's in the present moment. It's in just being present to the mystery of eternity, which is just with us all the time. You know, when Jesus was saying, do this in memory of me, he was saying two things. He was saying, break the bread in memory of me. Relive this liturgy so that I am always with you in this moment. But he was also saying, do this in memory of me as referring to the fact that he was living his life for others. And I think that's all, you know. I think that if Jesus was fully human, then he couldn't have fully anticipated the following day. He couldn't have fully anticipated, because that would be to say that, you know, that he has some sort of special powers of prescience that override his humanity. But the theologians, very early on after the resurrection, as the new church emerged, they were very quick to talk about Jesus being fully divine. It was the complete incarnation of God. And yet at the same time, he was fully human. Fully human. And there's no getting away from that, you know. Fully human. And that's what's unique about this moment. The breaking of bread. Do you know it was used by a lot of, when liberation theology was fashionable, they used to use the word compañeros. The same way as let's say in the old days, socialists or communists would use the word comrade. Comrade was like, you know, we're on the one side in the battle against the enemy, whatever, you know, capitalism or colonialism, and we're comrades in arms. Now, in South America, which was deeply Christian, when the liberation theologians began to engage with where people were going, people were moving towards a more democratic and socialist view of how to organize society, and the idea that liberation theologians had was that you must accompany the people. You must be with them. So, like, it's not for you as a priest or as a minister to judge people and tell them, oh, you're on the wrong road. No, it's the opposite. It's to be with them, even in their sinfulness, even in their brokenness. And that's exactly what happened in Ireland between 1600 and, you might say, 1850. 1650, 1850. There's 200 years of that time of penal law. And that was a time when priests in Ireland accompanied the people. They were there with them, hidden in poverty, under the hedge, in the ditch, at the funerals, in the graveyards, even though they were banned. And that accompanying the people is what the people needed. Not like political advice, but just to be with people in their suffering. And so in the liberation theology days, the word that was a buzzword was compañeros. You know, that you were companion with the revolution. And of course, the word compañeros, to be a companion, companos, comes from to share bread. It comes from to break bread. It's amazing how this theological idea, this moment of the Eucharist and its institution on what we call Holy Thursday, gave to the world this idea of the ritual breaking of bread, where the priest does this and then it is not him but Christ doing it. The ritual allows us into eternity. The ritual is the architecture of heaven within which we belong to the one moment. So the ritual is not repeated. It is the ritual is just the one embodiment. And in this moment of breaking the bread and sharing the cup and saying, this is my body, this is my blood. So we all become one with this Jesus. In what way? Well, lay down your life. I lay down my life. Do this in memory of me. So there's two levels. There's the level of, you know, I'm doing this ritual of breaking bread. Do this in memory of me. But also, I'm laying down my life. I'm laying down my life. Do this in memory of me. And it always seemed to me really, really important that when some theologian asked Jesus at one particular occasion, so what do you think are the two major commandments? Right? This was a theological discussion with people who were highly qualified, and they were checking them out and they were saying, so what do you think are the two major commandments of the Lord? And he said, love God, love your enemy. So it's like to recognize and pay attention to transcendence, to the mystery of how the ground of all being is present to us. We all in ourselves carry this sense of God's presence. That's half the story. And the other is, live your life for somebody else. Do this in memory of me. Lay down your life. Love your enemy. I mean, yes, love your neighbor. But that comes with the knowledge that somewhere else he had also specified that really your neighbor, the crucial one is the enemy. And that brings you to a full unity with everything that's in the Buddhist scriptures. And also in most other major religions. That renunciation, letting go of your own ego, allows through it. You don't get in the way of the bigger energy that is within you. There's an energy inside us that is much bigger than our tiny little individuality, ego lives. And letting go of the ego, how do you do that? This is Buddhist now. This is Buddhist. They would say, well, the simplest way to do it, if you want to short circuit all the, you know, hundreds of pages of philosophy and practice that you might do as a monk, just serve somebody else. Just live your life for somebody else. Just wish other people well. And just even wish them well. Like you don't have to die. You don't even have to put hours into it. It all begins with that disposition of thinking about somebody else. I find, to be honest with you, I find my cats help me in that regard. I have particularly a big black tom called Charlie, because he's been with me now since about 8 or 9 years. And on times when I was really, really down and depressed, when I was depressed and physically ill, when I was in a black hole, I could sometimes get out of bed, I could sometimes sit on the sofa and either be utterly miserable in my own agony, or I could look over at the little basket in the corner where Charlie would be snoozing, and I would say his name, and he'd come up on the sofa and he'd crawl onto my stomach and he'd start, do you know the way they knead you? I mean, I don't mean N-E-E-D, I mean K-N-E-I-D. You know, with his paws, like he was making bread, making dough on my belly. And there's loads of theories as to why a cat does that. Whether it's, you know, that they want to induce, it's a memory of when they were babies wanting to induce milk, or whether they're trying to massage you, or why they... Some people said that the cat, Charlie, instinctively knew where I had a dysfunction. So my illness was related to my gut. And they said that maybe there's an instinct in him that can smell. It says there's something not well there and I'm trying to heal it, massage it. I don't know, but certainly the comfort I got from just minding Charlie on those evenings where I would maybe, you know, get him a little bit of food or make sure that he was comfortable, or maybe not turn him out at night and leave him in his basket at night. It just having a relationship with that beautiful little animal, for me, saved me many's a time, saved me. And that's not to mention, obviously, of course, the humans in my life, which I'll not go into, but they're just, you know, 10 times stronger in the kind of dynamic that happens. And all I'm saying is that lay down your life for somebody else, to live for somebody else, is not like a big sacrifice. It's not like you're going to have to go out and die for somebody. It's just, the best I can say is that it's an attitude. It's an attitude. It's like living in your heart instead of living in your mind. Okay? You can do a practice sometimes of becoming aware. Be still, be physically still, and become aware in your mind. So your mind is aware of your environment and the things around you in the room and the walls and the, you know, the table and wherever you're sitting, in your body and your breath. So you become aware. And you're doing this with your mind. And then, let's say you visualize or think about somebody that you love beside you. In Tibetan Buddhism, in Tara practice, you visualize your parents and your family and your relations and your close friends, and you visualize them all around you as if they're all in a circle and that everybody is in the same posture as you and everybody is silent and everybody is meditating. You visualize them. Now, this is all in your mind. Then you try and allow, what they say, your mind to go down into your heart. So you begin to feel as if the center of your consciousness was in your rib cage. And if this center of consciousness was not just being aware of the people around you now, but actually actively sending them love. You know, you could see your beloved in front of you, or a child. And you could feel from your heart, from in your rib cage, there's a kind of an energy going out that says, I'm loving you in this moment. And there is a way in which your consciousness almost physically moves to your heart when you do that. I am loving you in this moment. Sometimes in the Buddhist practice, you get people to, they'll visualize light coming from your heart to the other person. So you visualize, let's say there's a Buddha, the Tara, female Buddha, and you see her before you in the air, and you visualize that from her heart come rays of light, and those rays of light enter your crown chakra, top of your head. and they flow down into your heart, into your whole body, into every pore of your being physically, into your toes and fingers. The light from Tara comes down into you and fills you up until you're full with the light of Tara, physically. It's a physical meditation. And then the reciprocal, the follow-up to it is where you visualize all those people that have already, you've already imagined them there around you, and you begin to see rays of light coming out of your heart in 360 directions, right? Full circle. Rays of light hitting the hearts of every single person that you know, everybody that you love, and everybody that you actually dislike. You're sending them all love, sending love into the cosmos. That's a very powerful Buddhist practice. It's called Tara practice. They do it in Jampaling, that Tibetan Buddhist place in Cavan. Great place to go if you ever want a break for meditation. But it's so similar, you know, to this moment that happened Holy Thursday. Do this in memory of me. So he's doing the ritual. And the ritual is like, do the ritual in memory of me, but it's also laying down my life. When supper was ended, he took the cup. Again, he gave you thanks and praise, gave it to his disciples and said, take this, all of you, and drink from it. This is the cup of the new covenant, of salvation in a new way. Do this in memory of me. And again, you see, he's saying to drink from this cup is, this is my blood. You drink this to drink my blood, to be one with me. But also, it has the resonance that the way I'm living in these hours, and tomorrow morning, or whenever the police come for me, into the garden in Jerusalem, I will in some way, by laying down my life, I'm declaring a new agreement between humanity and God. So it's like saying, we are going to journey through the dark, but we are going to do this because God will be with us. We're not going to be abandoned by God. We're not going to leave the present moment as a joyful place and be taken away into some sort of dungeon of terror and unhappiness. No. But we are really going to journey into the valley of death. We are really going to journey into the dark. And we are going to go there with a light inside us that comes from breaking this bread, from drinking this cup. Do this in memory of me. You know, it's like a template. It's like a shape of how to live your life. Just the entire life can be lived. The whole cosmos is addressed. The whole meaning, the totality of mystery in the universe is all absorbed into this one single moment, which is the Eucharist, which is an eternal moment. It is one moment. It happened once. But it's simply that in the tradition, every time there is a Eucharist, a Mass, it is the same one single moment that is retained, not repeating itself, not similar, not identical to. No, it is the one single moment. Because it's a moment outside time. It's the moment of love that I know and you know. It always repeats itself. And when it repeats itself, it's not an identical moment, it's the same moment. When you look into somebody's eyes and you feel your heart is loving them, you feel that an energy inside you that's reaching out, is transcending your body with love. A child, a lover, whatever. You're feeling, I love this person. I love this person. When you're in that moment, you know. It's not identical to some previous moment where you felt the same. It's the same moment. And that's why people are prepared to die for love. People are prepared to sacrifice for love. People are prepared to walk over the cliff blindfolded for love. Because when you reach love, you're outside time. You've gone beyond. You've transcended the linear lifetime. You could lay down your life now for love. And that moment awakens in you. It's one single moment. And think about all the times it happens in one person's life, in your life or my life. Then think of all the millions of people alive to whom it happens. Then think of all the people in history to whom it happens. And in some sense, what the Eucharistic moment of Holy Thursday does is that it gathers up past, future, global. All love is one single moment. Do this in memory of me. And there are people yet unborn who will grow up and experience love, and they will dedicate themselves to other people out of love, and they will find happiness. And they're yet unborn. Because love is eternal. And that's the Eucharist that was instituted on Holy Thursday. And you can't think of Good Friday without it. It is everything to do with Good Friday. It is the meaning. It's like, it's the insulation that carries us through, well, I'll say me, carries me through the darkness. So what the Mass does, or Holy Thursday does, the very idea, do this in memory of me, is like there's one single reality. And I'm living at the surface. I'm living in time in a linear way. But there's a deeper reality, always. And if that's true, when I'm young and healthy and in good form, then it's even more true, and it's a great consolation when things fall apart. When things fall apart as they did on Good Friday, and we remember it every year, we go through the same story. And it's a very powerful one. It's very well. It's a good story. You know, from the agony in the garden to the scourging at the pillar and the crowning with thorns and the walk on the Via Dolorosa And then Jesus is nailed to the cross, the fourth sorrowful mystery. Jesus is nailed to the cross. And then the fifth, Jesus dies on the cross. Dies, human, dies. End of story. Complete end of story. That's how it ends. It's a powerful story in itself. But it means nothing without Holy Thursday. So, I'm putting this up now. It's just coming up to 2 o'clock on Good Friday. And I think St. John's Passion by Bach is being broadcast live on Radio 3, BBC Radio 3, from Manchester. And there will be many, many beautiful celebrations in the next few hours, using classical musicians and geniuses who created beautiful works of art. And that'll all happen. And if you have time to go into that space and reflect on the darkness of Good Friday and find consolation in it in relation to your own life, you know, find how, by going through the story of this journey Jesus made to his own death, by going through it with the knowledge of Holy Thursday inside it, you know, that before it happened, he said these other things. He said, "This is my body, this is my blood, given up for you. Do this in memory of me." He had gathered everybody into a new covenant that awakens in us God's presence. And it's with the knowledge of that that we then go through Good Friday and meditate on his death, knowing that going through that liturgy is like going through our own death already. It is like ritualizing our own death, knowing that even in that darkness, we hold the light. We hold the light of Christ inside us. I hope you have a really, really good time on this Good Friday. And if you don't get a chance today because you're busy, I think it's possible to find Good Friday as a space inside you on any day. I find it works for me. Sometimes it's like 3 days later and I'm celebrating Easter, or 3 days later and I'm celebrating Good Friday. It's like a shape. It's an emotional journey. It's a psychological space. It opens up your heart in a particular way if you meditate on the Eucharist and all that was said and happened on the night before Jesus died. And then you go through the story of his death and suffering. It becomes a space. And I hope it's one that you find in yourself, where there is peace and joy and love. And then that's a happy Easter. So thank you for being here. Bye-bye.